You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
This week, the new majority Republican House of Representatives vowed to make good on its promise of cutting domestic spending for the coming year by between $50 to $100 billion. Those amounts exclude at least one area where many Americans have called for major reductions: military spending. For decades, Lockheed Martin has been at the top of the list of suppliers of weapons and aircraft to the U.S. government, and in his latest book, Prophets of War, Prophets spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, William Hartung looks at how that company elbowed out its competition and how it has wielded an inordinate amount of power over U.S. foreign policy and defense spending. It's published by Nation Books, and I'm very pleased that it has brought William Hartung back to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
When we talk about military defense spending, what dollar amount are we talking about in any given fiscal year?
Well, now we're at about $700 billion a year, which is the highest level since World War II. And it's increased every year for the last 14 years, which is unprecedented in our history. So it's really at a tremendous level right now.
Does all that money go to contractors?
Well, they get about $300 billion of it, so not quite half, but a healthy portion thereof.
And Lockheed Martin is the government's biggest contractor?
Yes, both for the Pentagon and for other agencies. They get in total $36 billion a year, which is about $260 per taxpaying household.
And how close are their competitors to that amount?
Well, Boeing is at about $23 billion versus Lockheed Martin's $36 billion. So they've got a healthy lead.
Once a contract is granted, how much of that money goes into research and development? And how much actually goes into producing something?
Well, the R&D phase can be quite long for some of these systems, sometimes 10 years or more. But the real money comes during production. So sometimes things are rushed into production to get that additional funding, even though they may not be ready.
On the other hand, I'm assuming a fair amount of money has gone into things that have never been produced.
Well, yes. And in Lockheed Martin's history, they had a helicopter in the 60s called the Cheyenne, which was supposed to be able to fly like an airplane and land like a helicopter. And they spent several billion on that and never had a working version. So it's something that happens, you know, frequently.
Well, we're talking about military things, but you write about Lockheed Martin's reach beyond military aircraft and weapons. Didn't they try to get into welfare reform?
Yes. In the 90s, they had this idea that would be the big new area because of the welfare reform bill, which allowed states to privatize provision of services. And they had a big contract they were going after in the state of Texas, where they wanted to be the main conduit for welfare, food stamps, and Medicaid. It was one of their few losses because they didn't know the local political terrain. The local union had commercials that said, "Do you want the company that brought you the $3,000 toilet seat to run public services in the state of Texas?" And that seemed to put some people off.
What else have they tried to get into?
Well, they're now been quite successful in kind of federal information technology. They work for the Census. They work for the IRS. They work for the Postal Service. They're helping the National Archives digitize information. So they've really got a farther reach than just building weapons.
But this doesn't sound like a synergy kind of thing. This sounds to me like more like conglomeratization. Did they just buy small companies that offered other kinds of services that had nothing to do with producing aircraft?
Well, frequently they did buy their way into the markets. And I think the common thread is to get these contracts, you have to lobby the government. And I think that's really their probably strongest skill.
Lobbying, that's even
yes.
Better than producing weapons. There were just initially a small aircraft company created by two brothers. How much did the brothers know about airplanes when they started?
Well, you know, they were kind of self-taught. I mean, one of the brothers had not really been schooled except at home by his mother. They knew a little bit about bicycles. The brother Malcolm learned a bit about cars. And then they were enthusiastic about it. And they, you know, they worked in a small garage in San Francisco to build their first plane.
And when was that?
1916.
So not long after the Wright brothers. When did they become a formidable company? Was it World War II that helped them?
Well, yes, they actually went bankrupt in their first incarnation. Then they were purchased by something called the Detroit Aircraft Corporation, which was supposed to be the General Motors of the sky. And that sort of limped along through the 30s. But then they got billions of dollars of contracts for World War II, and they went from what had been a company of 15 employees at its outset to 91,000 employees by 1943.
And then what happened after the war? Did they fear they'd go bankrupt again?
Well, there were fears. In fact, their CEO, Robert Gross, referred to it as those short, appalling weeks. So the war was over, which was a good thing, but the business was plunging, which was a bad thing.
Before the Korean War, how did the company make its case to Congress to continue to buy aircraft?
Well, they tried to and succeeded in getting several air policy boards together, which were mostly composed of people with an interest in the industry, either contractors or people in the Air Force. And they made the case for a radical increase in air power as part of an anti-communist thrust. And so they wanted, for example, an 80% increase in military spending, most of it for aircraft.
And since jets were the new way, I imagine that really helped them because you had to because the Air Force was pretty much during World War II all propeller planes.
Yeah, that transition really was important for them. And also initially they had a foothold in the airliner industry, which later they sort of ran afoul of. So they had a number of areas where they were strong. And really the Korean War is what brought them back up to, formidable company again.
Why did they run afoul of the airliner industry? Boeing has done quite well in that area.
Well, they had the L-1011, which was a follow-on to a plane called the Constellation, and they just could never get it right. It didn't perform as well as the Boeing planes. It was costlier in many cases. And so throughout the 60s, they really were, trying to make the effort to sell that plane, and they were just not very successful.
Did anyone in the Pentagon or the government voice concerns about stockpiling all of this aircraft? Which, especially as time went on, unlikely to be used in combat?
Well, it seemed to be the case that they always felt that more was better. And this notion that you wanted weapons in reserve, that also you wanted industrial capacity in reserve in case you had sort of a World War II-style conflict, which was not in the cards in the nuclear age, but there was sort of this hangover in terms of strategic thinking.
Well, we had President Eisenhower, who ended the war in Korea, and he made that famous speech about the military-industrial complex 50 years ago. Hadn't he been a supporter of the military-industrial complex until he made that speech?
Well, in certain respects, yes. I mean, he appointed the head of General Motors as his Secretary of Defense, and the apocryphal story is that during the hearings for that nomination, Charles Wilson was asked, well, isn't there a conflict here of having, an arms maker executive running the Pentagon? He said, well, what's good for General Motors is good for America. And so that kind of is the question now is, is what good for Lockheed Martin best for America, or is there a bit of a contradiction in terms of their interests and our broader security interests?
Let's listen to a little bit of President Eisenhower's famous speech.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
So was he talking about the influence of Lockheed Martin when he was saying that? Was that a veiled reference?
Well, his biggest problem at that point was Boeing and the bomber lobby. And they were trying to get him to build something called the B-70 bomber, which never was built. But even people in his own administration were lobbying for it, and sort of an insubordination in a way in calling for the bomber. And Lockheed had a reasonably good decade in the 50s. They built the U-2 aircraft, which is important in spying on the Russians. They built the C-130, which was a reliable transport plane. So they probably were not as big a problem at that point. Their real issues came in the 60s and 70s.
Was Eisenhower at all concerned about the amount of money we were spending on arms that we were unlikely to use?
Yes. His whole concept was we needed a balance between what we needed to spend for defense and how to protect our fiscal, situation. And so he had said at one point we shouldn't spend one more dime on defense than needed. So he obviously had some serious tussles with this self-interested lobby.
My guest is William D. Hartung, director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. He's written about arms and armaments for many publications. His most recent book is called Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, published by Nation Books. Just yesterday, pictures surfaced of a Chinese stealth fighter that might be superior to the U.S.'s F-22 aircraft. Should that be a matter of concern?
Well, I think it's probably overblown. Secretary of Defense Gates has said that, you know, even if we stop building the F-22, which we have done, we would have probably 20 to 25 times as many advanced fighter planes as China has even 10 or 15 years from now. So I think they're certainly trying to improve their technology, but I think they have quite a ways to go to really catch up.
But isn't there a concern that China could sell some of its planes to countries that are hostile to the United States or its allies, North Korea, for example?
Well, I think the question is, you know, are they willing to give them away to a country that is unstable on its borders? Because most countries can't afford these things anymore, other than in the Persian Gulf or the what used to be the hot economies of East Asia. And so, you know, in the Cold War days, the Soviet Union basically was giving this stuff away to its allies. And I don't think in this climate that's particularly likely, nor do I think China has, you know, an interest in some of the countries that were once called the axis of evil.
You said that Eisenhower was probably referring to Boeing when he talked about undue influence. Was Boeing a more important supplier at the time than Lockheed Martin?
I think they were in similar range. Lockheed's difference was that it was supplying also to the CIA, which was the contractor for the U-2. And so it had a little more diverse customer base within the government.
But he was also talking about Eisenhower about lobbying. How much does Lockheed spend on lobbying and campaign contributions?
Well, in the most recent cycle, $12 million, which, you know, by the standards of, say, you know, the pharmaceutical industry or the banks is not huge, but they are very strategic. So, for example, the incoming head of the Armed Services Committee, a fellow by the name of Buck McKeon, they're his biggest contributor, and they have a major facility in his district. Likewise, Daniel Inouye, who heads the Appropriations Committee in the Senate.
So they give to both parties. And and Lockheed has, on many occasions, argued that jobs would be lost if cutbacks were made. And that is why they get support from so many people in Congress, because they wind up manufacturing things in districts all over the country?
Yes. I mean, I think they overstate it. You know, they talked about for the F-22 having facilities in 44 states, but they would not yield up that information when asked by reporters exactly where these facilities were. And I looked at their jobs estimates, and they were probably, oh, about twice what the real number of jobs were. So jobs are important, but perhaps not as important as the company would claim.
But it is an effective argument in a time of high unemployment, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think unless we develop, you know, we strengthen the economy, we develop some other sources of manufacturing jobs, it's going to remain a potent argument for the industry.
And you write in the book that there was a strategic decision from the outset by Lockheed to place production plants in key congressional districts.
Yes. They offered during a problematic period for their C-5 transport air class to put a plant in the district of Mendel Rivers, who ran the Armed Services Committee in the House. And his slogan when he campaigned was Rivers Delivers, because he brought so much military money into his district.
My guest is William D. Hartung. His latest book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, published by Nation Books. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with William D. Hartung. His book, Prophets of War, P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. It's published by Nation Books. There have been cutbacks. Lockheed lost its F-22, but it wasn't it given the equivalent of a bailout? Can comparisons be made to the recent banking crisis?
I think so. They were the first major corporation, along with Chrysler, to get a government bailout, and this was in the early 70s. And one of the staffers who worked with Senator Proxmire, who opposed that bailout, said basically there was kind of an eerie comparison to now. Basically, they were arguing that Lockheed Martin was too big to fail and that therefore we had to give them government-subsidized loans.
Well, Boeing is in serious trouble. Isn't it too big to fail?
Well, I think any of the large arms manufacturers can make that argument. And the Pentagon will basically say we need what is known as the defense industrial base. We need to be able to turn to these companies in case there's an upsurge in the need to build weapons. And so they usually take care of them one way or the other. If not with loans, then with contracts for weapons that may or may not be needed at the moment.
How much did Lockheed get from the government?
Well, you know, it was tiny by today's standards, $250 million bailout, which would be about $2 billion in today's money. So it would be, you know, it wouldn't register with some of the big, you know, TARP and other bank buildups.
But as in the banking crisis, at the time Lockheed was seeking government help, there were reports about Lockheed's production oversights, mismanagement.
Well, yes, not only in the Cheyenne helicopter, which I mentioned before, which never worked, but the C-5A transport plane was $2 billion over its estimates, which was the largest cost overrun in history up to that point, and it could not do its mission. It was supposed to be able to land on a short landing field, and it never did achieve that.
It seems to me whenever I read about any of these programs, overruns are almost expected. Should overruns just be written into the proposals when they start?
Well, I think actually if they were more honest about the costs, they would probably be able to lower the costs, you know, ultimately. Because what happens is the companies buy in at a low price knowing that they're going to come back later for more money. And as a result, designs are different, spare part purchases are different, and it probably ultimately is less efficient than if, you know, up front they said, look, this is going to cost you real money.
Is any of this the result of corruption and other things, or is it just simply that they're underbidding?
I think there's an aspect of corruption in the sense that on something like the C-5A in the 60s, they knew full well that it was going to cost more. And in fact, when the contract was sort of rigged for them because they were in the district of the state of Senator Richard Russell, a mentor of Lyndon Johnson, they actually came in lower than Boeing, even though they had a more sophisticated, complicated design. And I think they knew full well that that would be made up.
There were people in Congress who stood strong against the bailout of Lockheed. Were they just simply people where Lockheed didn't have any manufacturing facilities in their areas?
Almost entirely. Senator William Proxmire of Wisconsin was the biggest opponent, and he had very little in the way of defense production in his state. And when they looked at the vote breakdown, the votes of people with Lockheed facilities were 100% for them. Some of the McDonnell Douglas people voted against it because they were hoping if Lockheed went out of business, McDonnell Douglas would get more business as a result.
I'd imagine that when there are fewer purchases from the U.S. government, that companies like Lockheed look abroad.
Well, it's a big moment for that. Arms sales are at record levels, about three times what they were when President Bush took office. And there was just a big $60 billion deal with Saudi Arabia, which is mostly a Boeing deal, but Lockheed Martin has a piece of it as well. So the companies are looking overseas to sell things like missile defense systems, combat aircraft, even fighting ships to make up for any lull or, leveling off of Pentagon spending.
And why would Saudi Arabia need a lot of fighter jets?
Well, I think most of it is kind of a prestige thing to say, you know, we can afford top-of-the-line fighter aircraft and therefore we're going to have them. Arguments have been made that they can, you know, join us and if we invade Iran or, you know, they can use it against terrorists. But I think that's highly unlikely. So I think it is really more of a, you know, it's like to show they can do it.
But hasn't there also been talk about bribes and buying influence in some of these foreign government contracts?
Well, the biggest period for that was in the 70s, where Lockheed bribed Japanese prime minister. They had a little guidebook for Italy, and the prime minister was known as Antelope Cobbler but they couldn't figure out who it was because over the two-year period, there had been three different prime ministers in Italy. So they never figured out which one of them was the antelope cobbler that was getting the bribes.
But in Japan, that became a serious crisis. Isn't it against the United States law to bribe foreign companies?
Well, after the scandal in the 70s, they developed the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which does outlaw bribery. Now, different modes of influence are used, mostly kicking back business to the country making the purchase. So, for example, saying you can build the engine in your country, or sometimes we'll help you market your exports if you buy our plane. So it's legalized, but there is still that element of a quid pro quo that you had during the bribery days.
Well, even in the bribery days, Lockheed, for example, argued that they weren't bribes, they were commissions.
Well, yes. And, you know, when asked about it by Senator Proxmire, Lockheed executive said, you know, even if we don't know where these payments are going, even if the, you know, the intermediary is sticking it in his pocket, as long as we get the deal, that's all we care about.
And don't they also argue that if they don't do it, their competitors will and somebody else is going to get the contract?
Yes. I think the French are probably the biggest boon to the U.S. Industry because of their, you know, illegal practices over the years. And so that is a big argument. I think the amount of corruption in France is overstated by the U.S. industry because it gives them sort of a foil, almost like the Soviet threat in business terms to point to.
Well, when we talk about domestic airlines, or I mean when we talk about consumer airlines, we talk about the Airbus. In the past, I was much more conscious of France and England as competitors for fighter planes as well and bombers. Are they pretty much out of the business now?
Well, the United States in one recent year had 3/4 of the global market in weapons sales. So it's much less frequent for the Brits or the French to win a deal. Although when they do, as they did in South Africa and Saudi Arabia, there has been major corruption involved.
And now Russia is grounding some of its own jets. So is that an opening for American aircraft manufacturers?
Well, it depends. You know, there's not a lot of market left that Russia had. But I think the big prize now is India. And when the president went there, one of the things he talked about was selling both air transport, military craft, cargo aircraft, and also fighter planes to try to sort of put his pitch into the Indian leadership.
My guest is William D. Hartung. His latest book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, published by Nation Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Were there any concerns that some of the weapons that we have sold to these other countries will fall into the hands of countries we would prefer not to have them?
Well, it's happened in the past. In one of my earlier books, I described it as the boomerang effect, where basically you would sell to a country like Iran or Iraq or Somalia or others, and those weapons would then be used against U.S. troops either directly due to a change of government or because they leaked into the hands of warlords and in some cases even terrorists. So a lot of that is the low end of the trade, things like guns and ammunition. But there is that danger in the future that even combat aircraft could come into use against the U.S. or its allies.
We've talked about the various ways that companies like Lockheed apply influence. You write also about the revolving door effect. Is Lockheed particularly adept at using that?
Well, there was a study by the group called the Project on Government Oversight. And over the period studied, Lockheed Martin had 200 officials that went back and forth between the company and the Pentagon. And these were people like the person who oversaw the F-22 program going on their board of directors at a time when that program was troubled. People like a guy who ran the military space program for the Air Force who had done similar work for Lockheed Martin. So a lot of these are very precise kinds of connections that can help them when they have their friends in government.
On the other hand, an argument can be made that these are the people who understand all the ins and outs of these programs, and we don't want somebody who has no idea, has to learn it from scratch.
I think in some cases there's truth to that. In some cases, you know, you have executives who really know about moving money around, may not know about the technical aspects of the aircraft.
Going back for a moment to President Eisenhower's speech, he called for an informed citizenry. Much of what you uncovered on military defense spending goes over a lot of people's heads. It seems almost an impossible task to understand how defense spending works. So how do we remain informed?
Well, I think, you know, it's responsibility of myself and others to try to break it down to the simplest levels possible, which is not an easy task, I agree. Some of the simpler things, like the $7,000 coffee maker in the Reagan years or the $600 toilet seat, which actually was a toilet cover that the company tells us, it gives
some
sense.
Does that make it any better?
Well, it sort of ruined some of the satire. You know, like Herb Block at the Washington Post had a picture of Caspar Weinberger with a toilet seat around his neck. So without the toilet seat, he'd have to wear, you know, the cover as a hat or something. So at least in that sense, it was different.
Your book gives us a picture of a company that over the years has used all of its support and influence to argue that there are threats to the United States, in some cases when there were none. How do they argue their case today where the threats are more likely from small groups of terrorists than a world power like the Soviet Union?
Well, I think their best bet is China. Although China is not anywhere near where we are militarily, it's a rising economic power. You know, perhaps in a generation, they might be a superpower militarily. So I think what they do is they say, well, there's this threat on the horizon, and we need to start now to build up for it. And I think it's certainly in terms of things like combat aircraft, that's the only thing they have going for them because you certainly don't use them to fight terrorists.
Does anybody buy that? China's economy is so tied to the U.S. economy that it seems unlikely that there would be a war unless there were a total revolution in the government there.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think there are people who are sort of stuck in a military mindset. And, you know, as Colin Powell said at the end of the Cold War, we're running out of enemies here. But the system, in a sense, needs enemies to sustain its political support and its monetary support.
Now, Robert Gates pulled the plug on the production of certain aircraft produced by Lockheed Martin, among others. Have they been applying pressure?
Well, they lost the fight over the F-22 combat aircraft, but—
How did they lose it after they had been able to win the fight so many times in the past?
Well, I think partly, you know, Gates put up a good fight. He pointed out that this plane had never been used, even though we were fighting two wars. Also, he gave them a little kickback. He said, well, we'll add $4 billion to your F-35 fighter plane to make up for the $4 billion we're taking away from the F-22 program. So in a sense, they were big enough to absorb the blow.
It's kind of like almost like a bribe, isn't it?
Well, in a sense. And of course, now they're the only company that makes fighter planes for the Air Force. So they really can't lose unless the Air Force goes out of business.
Which is unlikely.
I think so.
So what is your prognosis? Lockheed Martin going to continue to thrive, or is it going to be, as it has been in the past, kind of an up and down sort of thing with a lot of manufactured threats along the way?
I think we're at a turning point now because of the deficit issue. The president's deficit commission called for as much as $100 billion a year in cuts over 10 years, which coincidentally is the amount that the Republican leadership wants to cut from civilian programs.
So although they've just cut that back to $50 billion.
They've realized that they probably can't get it done. In any case, I think, you know, as at the end of the Cold War, there's going to be real pressure now. And if anything, we will see a resurgence of very open and aggressive lobbying by the companies to try to keep that from happening. But it's I think it'll be a fair fight in some ways in terms of, you know, fiscal responsibility versus manufactured threats.
William D. Hartung is director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. His book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, is published by Nation Books. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.